Well, good day and welcome back to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. We've got a really unique episode for you tonight. I'm looking forward to it myself. I get the chance to talk a little bit more than I usually do. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's a great time to be here. We've got a lot coming up, including a little bit of discussion on what we're going to be looking forward to at EMS World Expo coming up in a couple of weeks in New Orleans, and hopefully we'll see some of you all there. And of course, someone else we're going to see there is my co-host, because we are on opposite sides of the country most of the time, but we're getting together, Sam Bradley, together again in New Orleans.
Yeah, and we got Dr. Joe here with us and Kevin, and of course, Expo always reminds me of when we first started talking about the Disaster Podcast, and that was right about 3 years ago at Expo. We started hatching that idea, and I found a picture in my Facebook memory of when we were in Las Vegas on that trip. And that's kind of where Joe and I sat for quite a while and talked about our adventures at Ground Zero and the Pentagon and got to know each other and started talking about the Disaster Podcast. So that'll be kind of always be a special time for me. And we can look forward to going to New Orleans here very soon and seeing each other. So we always know we got that twice a year, which is a good thing.
Definitely, definitely. So we've got a lot of good stuff tonight, and unfortunately, we're going to start off with a little bit of a down note because there was a really severe fire, and Sam, you saw it on the news first.
Yeah, I caught that. I couldn't believe it, and I thought, man, we really got to ask Joe about that because that's right in your town, Joe, in Memphis. They had a really bad fire. They lost a lot of lives. In fact, it was a record-breaking loss of life. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I can. Hi, guys. It's good to be back. So we had an extremely tragic fire early in the morning, middle of the night, before last, that was a relatively small house. And a call to 911 from an adult who was in the house. Saying that there was a fire and they were unable to get out. Fire services arrived and broke through the front door. And although the outside of the house looked very normal, I mean, you know, no obvious evidence of fire or even much in the way of smoke showing, the entire inside of the house was densely full of smoke. And ultimately resulted in 11 deaths, 8 of those children, and 3 adults. And it appears that the situation was an air conditioning unit, installed in a window that had not been very well installed. It was running off of an extension cord of some sort. The small home had burglar bars and that sort of stuff on most of the windows, and apparently the other exit to the house had been bolted shut. Unsure the reason why, but the only operating door in the house was unfortunately on the other side of the fire. That resulted from the extension cord being overloaded. And the person that called 911 was actually one of the adults in the house, none of whom survived. So it's been obviously a hugely tragic event for that family, an extended family, and also really hard on the guys that made that response. You know, you don't see firemen just openly weeping on a scene very often, but we had quite a few this week. It's been a really difficult week.
I can only imagine. So what are you doing for those guys, Joe? What do you do when you have that many firefighters involved in an incident like this?
Well, we've had sort of a continuous crisis intervention team interaction going on since the incident occurred. Lots of time spent with those guys, just working them through the situation. It was quite obvious that pretty much I think all but one victim was in cardiac arrest upon removal from the house. There is one 8-year-old, I think 8-year-old, if I recall properly, that is in the hospital and currently still alive and in pretty severe condition. So I don't know that he will survive either, but we can certainly say a prayer that he'll do well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the messages about fire safety there are pretty obvious, about making sure you have more than one egress. I don't know, those burglar bars, like, as much as they provide safety, they can also kill people. And I think this is a good evidence of that.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, again, this was a relatively small home, apparently a fairly well sealed home from, you know, the pictures that have been spreading through social media, et cetera. If you look at the outside of that house, you'd have a difficult time telling that there had even been a fire there.
Wow.
It sounds like it was very much a sort of smoldering kind of fire from this extension cord, and I assume probably carpet or something along the lines of that, that burned very slowly and produced lots of smoke and obviously carbon monoxide.
Was that an older home?
You know, it looked like it was probably built in the 1970s or so. If I recall properly, it was a brick exterior. You know, fairly traditional construction home.
Because I'm thinking there in terms of the electrical, because after a while, you know, you have to start worrying about the electrical being safe, especially when you're plugging in appliances in ways you probably shouldn't, like using extension cords. So that's something I'd always worry about in an older home.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I don't know that that's, you know, the investigation is obviously still underway, and we'll have some final details, I'm sure, in the next few days. But I think that was just sort of the preliminary thought of what had probably happened there.
Wow. Well, I wish your guys well. I'm sure we all do. So we'll be praying for them and sending healing energy to them, because I've never seen one incident with that many people involved, so I can only imagine. So on a lighter note, you and Paragon and your bunch went off to Tupelo. You just got back, right?
Yeah, literally just in the last little while. We had a great experience, 2 days of cadaver lab and a cadaver-infused disaster response training there for the trauma system in the North Mississippi area, and a lot of great participants and a lot of fun and a lot of great learning. So we're glad to be back in town, and another one coming up at the end of this week. So we're rolling.
Well, where are you going this week then?
This week, actually, at the toward the end of the week, we have some training for military special operations guys with our partners at Tier 1 Group, quite close to home. It's 20 minutes outside of town, so that one will be a day-long experience as opposed to overnight stuff.
Wow. Well, you're staying busy, so that's a good thing.
Indeed. Good stuff.
Yes. So I thought we'd have a little bit of fun tonight. We'll even let Jamie play. Usually he kind of shrinks into the background once we get started, but I'm going to pull him out of his closet this week. You know, we've talked about different specific disasters, especially during hurricane season. We talk about hurricanes and tornadoes and so forth, but I thought it would be fun just to have, and you guys didn't really prepare for this, and that was intentional, because I just want to see what's on the top of your head. So I looked at, I was hoping we could get BJ up tonight too, but I couldn't get a hold of him. But looking at different disasters, since some of the aspects of before, during, and after, and how we should handle them. And, you know, we all live in different areas, so we're going to be more familiar with certain types of disasters than others. But I thought it would be fun just to throw some questions out to you guys, and then anybody else can throw in any other ideas they have. Does that sound good?
Sounds good. I think Joe, Kevin, and I are all set.
All right. Let's have some fun.
Bring it on.
So, Jamie, let's start with you. winter storms. And of course, we got, as I sit here, it's 60 degrees and I've got a blanket over my lap in Colorado. And there's already snow in the mountains of Wyoming, which is less than an hour away. So we've definitely had a serious shift in seasons here in Colorado already. I'm looking at the different levels of warnings there are. There's outlooks, there's advisories, there's watches, and there's warnings. What are the real differences? And I'm sure this would be kind of the same for different types of disasters.
I think my understanding of this, and I'm not a weather expert, but my understanding is the things I really look for are the watches and the warnings. I think outlooks are really just weather reports. Looking down the road. Advisories, I think, are when you get to about the 48-hour mark, when they're starting to predict what could happen in a community, the 72 to 48 hours, they put an advisory out there that, hey, in the case of a winter storm, that you could expect different combinations of winter storm weather, whether it's a combination of snow and sleet or rain and snow or freezing rain or whatever they may call for. They'll give you an advisory that says for this given region, the weather could produce this type of precipitation and weather event for your community. Be aware. And that's kind of that advisory is there so you can go shopping. And if you need to get, make sure you have medicines in the house. If it's going to be a major blizzard event, and that's what they're predicting, you might be snowed in for 3 or 4 days. Do you have your medications and your prescriptions up to date so that you know, if you were planning on going out 3 days from now to refill that prescription, it might be a good idea to do it now just in case you're snowed in 3 days from now. Things like that. Then you move up to watches, and watches, I think, are something that within the next 24 hours, they're
looking. This says 36 to 48.
36 to 48. So
yeah.
they're predict. That's when they start predicting that they've kind of narrowed it down a little bit. And then warnings are impending, that they actually have a good idea now that the regions listed in the warnings are going to be getting the actual weather that they're predicting. So watches are kind of, all right, we're not quite sure, but you should be aware and pay attention to your weather reports and check in with us. And I usually think about when I see a watch, I usually say, all right, I'll check in every 8 hours or so. So yeah, but check in before I go to bed. And then I get up the next morning and I check in when I get up in the morning, that kind of thing. Warnings are more severe and obviously, I think, more predictive. When they put a warning out there, you're out in that 12 to 24 hour or less mark, and they know what's coming. Someone near to you is getting the weather they're predicting, and they think it's going to move in your general direction. So, you know, if it's snowing heavily in central Maryland, and we're in the eastern part of Maryland, and they're going to start predicting based on the temperature curve and things like that where the snow, sleet, rain line is going to be. And north of that is going to be a snow event. In the middle section of that, we're going to have combination of precipitation, which can be worse than snow, I think, in many situations, because you just get this freezing precipitation that causes travel issues, and you get a lot of motor vehicle accidents. You also get a lot of trees down because the ice forms on the tree limbs, and actually that heavy weight actually will pull more limbs down than just snow. And then south of that, you have just rain. So in our region here in the Mid-Atlantic, that's what we typically see. And we always try to watch that temperature grade. Where is the freezing point? Where is that freeze line? And north of it, we're going to get snow. And if that's where we are, then we're going to expect snow. So that's my understanding of those advisories. And I think they do a pretty good job. We talked about this in the past, that sometimes, you know, they get it wrong and then people complain that, I was prepared for a blizzard and we got a light dusting of snow. Well, you know, you get what you get. Sometimes the jet stream shifts something north or south and it turns into a rain event because it headed further south, or it heads north of you and you don't get anything. It is what it is. It's just, weather is unpredictable by nature, but it's the preparedness aspect that at least we can predict a possibility of type of event. And that's the thing that I try to we try to talk about here. We try to talk about the possibilities and to be prepared for those possibilities, because if something does happen, you know what to expect.
Yeah, and I'd much rather be prepared for a blizzard and have a dusting. And that's one thing I'm learning about Colorado and getting back into winter weather is, you know, the old rule that if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. And to the extent that you have communication, I think, for any of these events, I'm thinking specifically of hurricanes, because like you said, Jamie, whatever they predict an hour ago is going to be different an hour later, is to keep your eye on the news, keep your eye on the Weather Channel and watch where these things are going. So as they get closer, you have a better idea of what you might actually get hit with.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I do. And you know, my family laughs about it and ha ha, but we're prepared. We set up for these things. And the last time we got snowed in was last year. We got snowed in for, I think, 2.5 days before they opened our street up. So luckily, we kind of saw it coming. I paid attention to the advisories. I made sure we had plenty of food in the house, that, you know, we were set up with plenty of water. If the power went out because the power lines went down, it doesn't usually happen to where we are because a lot of the lines where we are underground now. But it's something to be aware of. And we did just fine. I mean, we were coasting along, having, you know, roasted marshmallows on the fire and having a good old time. But I also know there were people in our community that weren't. Because they weren't prepared and they had to call for help. And then we had to get snow plows and front end loaders because of the amount of snow in just to get a paramedic chase vehicle in to check on somebody, because they weren't prepared or they were elderly and unable to be prepared. So these are things that are challenges.
Your family's a little spoiled because they always know you're going to be on top of it, I think. is there any projection for the East Coast on what winter's going to be like? Because I'm hearing the neighbors discussing we're supposed to have a pretty nasty one here.
It's supposed to be a heavy snow winter, but you take that with a grain of salt. I mean, they're basically looking at world weather patterns and how the jet stream sets up coming down out of Canada. And they look at that and look at years past where they've tracked it. And luckily, I mean, they have almost 100 years of good solid weather data, or more, that they can check where they actually have been able to track the jet stream. And I think that's where they pull their data from. They look at what years past have been like when the weather patterns have set up in a certain way in, say, summertime or early fall, and they project out and say, well, on years like this, it's done this. And so that's how they make that prediction. We'll see. I've had years where they've predicted a lot of snow and it's been mild and, you know, not even very many freezing temperature days. So it is what it is. You just have to have
it's gotta be ready for that worst case scenario.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're good. Yeah. So Joe, out there in tornado country, one thing that's always been a question on my mind, I remember my first few years in Michigan, where we have tornadoes there, and we were always told to stand in one specific corner of the home, although I don't remember what that corner was. But in reality, where is the best place to go in your house, and what is the best thing you can use to protect yourself if you think you're in the path of this thing and you can't really get out?
So great questions. You know, in general, the idea is you would go to the corner of the house that is pointing in the most likely direction that the tornado would be coming from, which in this area is from the west. So you'd be looking for a southwestern corner most commonly. Certainly in this part of the world, actual tornado shelters are not an uncommon thing, including many which are, built into your garage or that sort of stuff. Many of those are underground, and some of those are simply concrete reinforced rooms in the home that are built there during the construction of the home. I think if you are caught in a situation like that, you want to go to the most protected part of the home, which is going to tend to be downstairs, certainly under an area that has significant protection to it. So, you know, I think underneath a staircase is a very common area. I think folks tend to think of the bathroom as a fairly protected area. I think the reason for that has to do with the fact that there's rarely significant amounts of windows in the bathroom, that the plumbing and piping and that sort of stuff in there might provide some additional protection from the walls being torn from the foundation, so that perhaps that's a safer area. And then the idea that you can get down inside something like a bathtub, where you have a protective surround that might provide you some additional safety. So, you know, I think taking something like a small mattress or something along those lines, and pulling on, or blanket, heavy blanket, and pulling on top of yourself inside a bathtub might be a reasonable alternative if it's all you've got and time is short.
Yeah, I remember watching one of these shows where some folks, the storm was coming up on them, and they were all driving around, so they stopped at this convenience store, and there were like 20 people there that had gathered up, and they ended up going in the walk-in cooler, and everything disintegrated around them but this walk-in cooler, even though they got trapped in it. But at least, you know, they all made it out alive. So probably because it was a self-contained type unit like that. So I can kind of see what you're saying. Any other thoughts from you other guys on that subject? Kevin?
Yeah, everything Joe covered was everything we've covered. The only thing I can add was when I was out in Kansas, they told us to stand in a doorway, the reason being because a doorway had more reinforcements in the frame for strength to prevent the house from falling on top of you. Never had a chance to actually test that, but that's what we were always told.
Isn't that a myth, Joe? Haven't they rethought that recently?
Yeah, I don't know that they're I've heard that as well. Unfortunately, I'm probably not an expert in that area, and my information is not very up to date. But I do seem to recall that has been challenged anyway with some more recent research.
Well, and being a USARC guy, I know you could probably speak to this, but there's a lot of controversy over the what exactly do they call it? The triangle of life, or someplace where you actually would be in a void if things were to come down around you. And there's some people that say, yes, that would be a great place to be, and other people that don't believe that's the case. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my sense is that there's certainly potential for void spaces in any significant building collapse. And that those are obviously going to be in a place where, you know, there are corners and that sort of stuff, that where things go from vertical to horizontal and meet so that the junction is stronger. I think, though, that being able to sort of predict where those void spaces are going to occur or are likely to occur are going to be very challenging and probably not very useful from a planning standpoint. I think it makes sense to try to get to shelter yourself in a corner or at the base of a wall as opposed to the middle of the room. But I think whether that is a void space that you can predict, I really question that. I think it's just you're going to be lucky enough to be in an area that you increase your chances that there'll be a protected void space there, but I don't think that it's significantly predictable.
Yeah, that would seem logical to me. Okay, Kevin, let's switch gears, and kind of based on our discussion the other day, you're going out into the wilderness, and of course, you know, the idea there is to prepare yourself for whatever. We'll talk more about that, but say you're packing really light. What are five things that you would take with you that you feel are essential to survival?
So five things. So I'm going to have something on me that I'm able to use to start a fire for both warmth, if I want to boil water for a cup of coffee or a meal, also at night so I can see. I'm also going to have something to help me purify or filter water, and also to collect water if I run out. So I'm not going to bring, because water is very heavy. So if I'll be out for an all day thing, something I can collect and purify water with. So if I have a fire, I can use a fire to boil the water. I'm also going to have something for shelter, which can be something as simple as rain gear or a hat or an extra jacket. I'm also going to have a tarp, because a tarp you can use for many different things. But shelter also begins with your clothing. So I'm going to avoid cotton if I can, because that is not very good at getting rid of moisture, and putting socks. Another thing I'm going to have is something for signaling. So in case I get lost or something happens to me and I can't walk, or I'm not mobile anymore and I need to call search and rescue to come in and get me, I'm going to bring some kind of signaling to help them find me. So if it's during the day and I make the call and they don't get to me until nighttime, you know, what can I use to signal them to say, okay, I'm over here, whether that be a flashlight, if it's during the day, a signal mirror, you know, flares. There's a lot of things out there that you can use. Another thing would be a map and compass or GPS, along with the knowledge of how to use them both. Because plenty of time people have been rescued and they've had them with them, but they didn't know how to use them. Another thing along with that is either a PLB, a personal locator beacon, or a spot device for signaling. And I'm also going to have extra batteries in case, for some reason, if it's cold, batteries, you know, can be used up a lot quicker. So if I need to change batteries on one of my devices, I have spare batteries. And the other thing I'm going to bring, as we mentioned in another podcast, is my brain. So the mind, if something were to happen, to stay calm is extremely important. And there's a saying, a tree. You don't necessarily actually hug a tree, but the idea is you just stop where you are, sit down, and think. And there's a mnemonic for that called STOPA. Stop, think, observe, plan, and act. So maintaining a calm presence of mind, being aware of your surroundings, so in case something does happen, you don't want to panic and run around and get lost and deviate from where you are, it is very important. And the thing I'm going to do before I even leave the house is file a trip plan together. So they know about where I am, and all the information on the trip plan, the vehicle you're driving, where you're going to be, what time to make the call if you don't hear from me. If I'm supposed to be back on Sunday at 6 o'clock, and it's 8 o'clock and you haven't heard from me, you know, it's time to make that call, because maybe something happened and I can't make the call. I'm unconscious. My phone doesn't have any signal. So the trip plan filed before I leave is also very important. And there's a lot of elements that go into that to help search and rescue.
Very true. So, well, you don't know how to count to five, Kevin, but that's great information. Seriously. Joe, you might get a kick out of this, because when we were talking on the phone, I have my ER doc out in the wilderness trying to outrun bad guys. And he's got his nitrile gloves in his pocket, and he found a thing of dental floss. So basically, it was Kevin's idea to bring up the fact they were obnoxious purple-colored gloves. So I had to make a balloon out of, you know, create a balloon out of the glove and tie it off with dental floss as a signaling device. And we were talking about the fact that he could also carry water in it. I'm sure you have a few thoughts on something you might use out there that maybe Kevin didn't mention.
Yeah, I like that one. Actually, Kevin covered a lot. I think a lot of the certainly the ones that are top of mind for me. I think the basics of caring for yourself, taking care of water and signaling to me are kind of the two number one, number two things. I think there's always a place for a Foley catheter.
I knew that was coming.
There you go. Got to get that in.
For that.
I think after that, it really is the other topics there that Kevin touched on as far as the things you're going to need to be able to take care of yourself over a couple of days if you're out there for that long.
Okay. You know, not everybody listened to our original Foley catheter show, so you're going to have to describe for the audience a few things you can do with a Foley catheter.
Well, sure. So we had a lot of fun with that on our, what's the primary thing that you, the most important thing that you need in the, in an austere environment to take care of yourself. And that conversation had to do with all very large number of uses that you can come up with for a Foley catheter, from literally making a tourniquet out of it to sealing an open chest wound and using it to make a slingshot and just any myriad of things that a Foley catheter could be turned into in an austere environment.
Of course, that may assume that it's in your scope of practice to be sticking a Foley catheter into somebody's chest. you need to have a level of comfort with that. But I love that. That came from one question I asked Joe, is what's the one thing you can't live without in an austere environment? And none of us expected that answer. So it's been kind of a running joke ever since. So, Jamie, back to you. You potentially, let's just say you drive a lot. You have, like Kevin, have a fairly long drive to work in the winter environment. What are some of the things you can do to prepare your vehicle? And kind of on the same token of what Kevin was talking about, what are those five things when you're out in the winter environment that you'd always want to have with you?
Well, in my area, it would be making sure you have a spare battery for your cell phone. That would be important to have with you because that's really the primary signaling device. And I think it can be used in many ways as a signaling device because you've got the flashlight function on many of cell phones now. GPS is built into it. So it really is a survival tool when used in appropriate settings in some places. An austere environment can be many different things. If you're snowed in on an interstate, It may not matter that you're only 20 miles outside of a major city and in a relatively suburban area. If you're stranded on the highway and you can't leave your vehicle, you're in an austere environment. So your cell phone may be the connection you need because you still have that signal to let folks know where you are, let folks know you're all right. Beyond that, for snow and wintertime, I always believe in the fold-up utility shovel that you can keep in the back of a vehicle very easily. And that's because as snow builds up around your vehicle, the routine usually is you turn it on for 5 or 10 minutes every hour to maintain some warmth in the vehicle. But before you turn the vehicle on, you always get out of the vehicle and make sure the tailpipe is clear. And that's where that shovel comes in. It also comes in handy if you do get stuck and you're able to dig out your vehicle. Maybe one wheel is stuck in snow and hung up. You can sometimes dig yourself out and get back on the main roadway. So that vehicle is that shovel can come in for multiple purposes there. Things like some kind of a protein bar or something like that, maybe a pack of them to keep in there if you're stranded. I mean, some people, we looked at that situation in Atlanta last year where the ice storm came and people were stranded in their vehicles for 18 to 20 hours just outside the city of Atlanta. And, you know, the interstates turned into parking lots because of the amount of ice that they got suddenly. In that situation, you know, having a couple of protein bars and, you know, 4 or 5 bottles of water and a battery for your phone is really going to do you well to get you through that situation, to keep in contact with people, to call for help if an emergency were to arise, and to hold you off until the National Guard comes down with their big trucks and drives by and makes sure you have water and makes sure you're not in immediate danger, and then keeps on going until the road clears up. So You know, those are the things I think of mostly. And I think I kept it under five. So I actually may have a few slots open I can lend to Kevin.
There you go. I'm thinking about things like, of course, extra blankets, but also things like space blankets in your car, because those don't take up a lot of space.
And
right?
I'm assuming that I'm dressed appropriately for the weather. So, I mean, if you're in the wintertime and, you know, you decide to go for a drive in shorts and a T-shirt, well, then you're going to need a blanket and some other things. But you're right. Yeah, a blanket or a rescue blanket of some sort would be helpful. You know, I do have a basic kit that I keep in the back of my car. It's a year round kit, and it has, you know, it has a chemical ice pack in it, and it has a chemical heat pack in it. You know, you can have some of those hand warmers or whatever you think, you know, the chemical hand warmers that you can use, that might help generate a little extra warmth if you're trying to get through a long night stranded in a vehicle. Everybody has their own list of things. I mean, my primary things are food and a means to keep myself safe from things like carbon monoxide poisoning from the vehicle and to help get the vehicle freed up if I need it.
Yeah, that's really critical. And I wonder how many people really know that. I mean, I had a superficial element of knowledge on that, but I'm glad we're going over this because who knows? I mean, and you're right. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen on the news where freeways are basically shut down and you have all these cars just disappearing into the snow. And that's why I was thinking about a blanket, because during that period of time when your engine is off, it's going to get darn cold in there. And I know I'd want one. So good point. Joe, a thought on tornadoes. What about after the storm? What is safe to do? Say you have some damage to your home, but it hasn't fallen down around your ears. And of course, you see some of these shows where they walk out and the entire neighborhood is gone. What are some of the things we need to be concerned about when we leave your home after a tornado?
Well, I think the primary issue there is just the hazards. If you've had a significant enough weather event, honestly, no matter what the source of the weather event, to have caused significant property damage, then, you know, I think you have to have an expectation that there are likely to be debris around your home that was not there prior to the storm. So you have to worry about the safety of walking outside and stepping on a, you know, a nail or a piece of metal roof or any of that kind of stuff. I think the other big concern would be downed power lines, where you could have a significant threat of electrocution or fire that might arise from a power line being down, especially if the power might at the moment be off. And then as the power comes back online, that circuit is suddenly energized, and now you have a potential source of fire there. So those kind of things are often in the offing in the near time right after an event like that. Then concerns over in a little bit longer time frame, things like contaminated water sources. Ongoing leaking chemicals of some sort, whether that's from a damaged storage facility or a leaking pipeline or a fire that's resulted in a leak there as well. So those things take a little bit longer to become an issue, but could clearly become an issue. And then if it's a weather event that involves, rain, wind, tornadoes, et cetera, then concerns over flash flooding and those kind of incidences that come on later.
That's true. It's not over when it's over, is it? Just like with hurricanes, there's always the concern with flooding after the fact. So, Kevin, I don't know if this would be as germane to you, but since we're kind of wrapping up here, I want to... Joe and Jamie, especially, to give me kind of an overview. Now, we talked at length in different episodes about safety kits. Jamie, you mentioned it's important to make sure everybody in your family has their meds, making sure you have important papers you don't want to leave behind in case your house disappears. But what about, give me something quick, starting with Jamie, on And you were talking about how your family just kind of depends on you to be prepared. How do you prepare your family? What are the things you do that say, if we're separated, or how do we get in contact with each other if the phone lines are down, or what are specific roles that you might have given your kids when they were young if there's a disaster?
Well, I mean, it starts with simple things, and it goes back to that story we had in the beginning, you know, the fire escape rescue plan, where, you know, very early on with my kids, we talked about, all right, you know, one of our neighbors, one of our next door neighbors, their daughter was our babysitter. And so we would say, hey, you're going to go over to Julie's house and ring the doorbell if there's a fire, and we send you outside. Don't just stand on the front porch. Don't come back in. You run to Julie's house and go on the front porch and ring their doorbell till somebody answers. And then you wait on the front porch, and that's where everybody's going to meet. And that was our plan, you know. So it starts with simple things, and starting with the local disasters that could befall your family, like a fire. And then you build out from that. And so they've become very used to, at an early age, the idea of, this is how we're going to get in touch with each other. This is how we're going to meet. We're going to have a meeting point. We're going to have a calling time, or whatever the case may be. And that's expanded outward and adapted to other situations, as the case may be. For us, it's usually either a hurricane or a snow event. And thankfully, both of those are pretty rare that are of any significance. But when they have happened, it's been, you know, I think our plan for our family, I've got a daughter in Ohio now. She's in an area that could get more likely to get tornadoes than I am. So I had a long talk with her about, you know, what I knew of preparing for tornado awareness and taking warnings seriously and watching the weather and being aware of your surroundings and things like that. So that she'd be aware. And then I said, you know, we're going to use social media to reach out to each other. If the phone lines are down or something like that, but you can get a signal somewhere. If a text message won't get through and you do get on and you're able to log in on somebody else's device for Facebook, use the Facebook functionality that allows you to tell people you're okay. So there's things like that. So I've tried to adapt to the circumstances and the changing times and the changing types of events that might face us.
Yeah, and I understand, because somebody we know here locally lives in a very rural area, that there's actually a phone function that you can get through Facebook Messenger. So we'll have to go back and take a look at that kind of thing. Any follow-up thoughts on that idea, Joe?
Oh, I think Jamie covered it very nicely. You know, my family's plan in the event we need to evacuate the house from a fire or something is to go to the mailbox. We're all going to meet at the mailbox. I think the only other thing I might add is the idea. I think social media certainly makes a tremendous amount of sense, but I think it also makes sense to have everyone call a designated family member who's in a different area.
Yes.
So everybody's going to call grandma and tell grandma, here's where I am and I'm okay, and, you know, et cetera, so that we all know who to reach out to be our information steward of everyone's location and status.
Makes a lot of sense. Any final words, Kevin? Any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, just a quick few. One thing I would add, just remind everybody, including our listeners, is if you have supplies packed in your car, as Jim was explaining, don't forget to periodically check them to make sure they're still working or in working order. For example, the ice packs and the cold packs, after a certain period of time, they go bad, especially down here in Texas. Being in the heat all the time will affect stuff. So make sure they don't expire. Make sure the batteries are good. Write the expiration date or when you bought the batteries. Put tape on the batteries or put the batteries in a little baggie and write the expiration date, or if they have one, or when you bought them, so you know how good they are, just as a reminder to check them coming up. Another thing is, in the event of last year where people were stranded on the highway for 20 hours, and this is more for your vehicle, make sure you have a plan to address the time when you need to relieve yourself. Something like a spare bucket, some trash bags.
I was going to ask about
some
that.
Yeah, I mean, they make a number of very cheap commercial items you can get, but something simple as, you know, a roll of toilet paper and a Ziploc or a double Ziploc bag in case it gets wet.
Yeah, yellow snow doesn't make itself.
Yeah.
That's when I'd
want to
be a guy. I know that.
Well, I had clipped some articles from the major snowstorm last year, and there was one incident, there was a bus full of school kids that were stranded, and they didn't have a bathroom. So you can imagine a bus full of teenagers trapped on the highway for 20 hours. That becomes, how do you deal with that? Because 20 hours, if it's 1 or 2 hours. Yeah, so plan that you're going to need to relieve yourself, and plan accordingly. Bring whatever items you think are appropriate, and try and keep everything as waterproof as possible. And then the other thing in that same incident, there was a lady who used Twitter to contact the state police to let her know that she was stranded, and it worked. They actually found her location and they came to her rescue.
And that's a good point, because cell phone towers will most likely be down, as well as landlines are going to be impacted if people still even have them. So, Jamie, we've done a whole bunch of training here, and it's hard to believe that our listeners couldn't have gotten something from this that they didn't know before we started. So I certainly did, especially when you, in terms of the winter stuff, because, again, that's, I'm going back to living in that environment. So training is a good thing, eh?
It is. And it's good to talk through these things, and it's good to revisit these topics from time to time, even for people like us who are supposed to be the experts. And one of the things I like is the way that, you know, the experts that of our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, and Joe and Jim and the rest of the team there, really help organizations go through and have these moments of revisiting what could happen, and giving them experiences that help impact and impress upon them in a very real way what to expect from these types of events. And Joe, you guys, we talked about you guys being down in Tupelo and talking to Special Forces folks in the coming week. It is imperative for organizations to have that kind of regular refresher training, and I think you guys do just an excellent job.
Well, thanks, Jamie. We certainly agree with you that experience is a powerful teacher. And, part of what we really strive to do is to give folks an opportunity to gain that experience, perhaps without the high cost of Mother Nature and fate that can require of you to obtain that sometimes. So that's really our goal, is to give you that opportunity to do so in a safe and a safe environment where the consequences are much less than they might be in a real world.
So, Joe, where can folks find you if they want to look up Paragon and maybe find out what they can do to bring you into their area?
Well, we have our own website at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We can be found on Facebook under the same name. Our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
And Joe, thanks again for your continued support. And, you know, we always urge the audience members to look you guys up and see what you have to offer, and continue to listen here to the Disaster Podcast about what you all are up to. So thanks a lot. Kevin, where can folks find you?
People can find me on my website, wildsafety.com, and there's links to all my social media locations there. You can also find me here at the disasterpodcast.com website, and also the Disaster Podcast Facebook group on Facebook.
Yay!
Yeah, and we're still continuing to use that, and we'll be putting out episode links there as well, and other discussions that come up throughout the course of the week, so check it out. Sam, what about you? Where can folks find you?
Well, hopefully not under the snow anytime soon. Starting to get me worried. But on social media, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, most certainly the disasterpodcast.com, and I hope you guys come over and either on the Facebook page or the website. Now you have more than one place to go and give us some of your thoughts or ideas. Or I'd love to hear maybe some of your things you've learned for disaster preparedness that we perhaps didn't mention, because we'd love to compile a good list of those. So please do that. And Jamie, what about you?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media places, and always over at DisasterPodcast.com. And like Sam said, we want to hear from you, so leave a comment on this episode with your thoughts, answer some of the questions yourself, share some questions you have with us, and we love to hear from you. And Sam, you know, we've talked about disaster preparedness and planning for different types of events and things, but it's always a little bit different than just hanging out in a normal day.
It is, and there's so much to know about each of these different types of disasters, but yet there's a lot of things that are common to all of them too. And that's just like Kevin said, bring your brain to the event. I think that's probably the most important thing. But, you know, in any case, it's very clear that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.